At one point when planning the service, I thought about focusing on the poem we just heard, The Work of Christmas. You've probably heard that poem before. It's a very popular poem in UU congregations, especially on the Sunday after Christmas, because it reflects our passion for justice. The work of Christmas, according to Howard Thurman, is to bring healing and wholeness wherever lives are broken. And that's something that really resonates with us. And to me, this poem carries extra weight this year. During this last year, we've seen so much hatred, violence, and suffering across the globe. It can be difficult to comprehend. And as we think about the work that lies ahead of us, it can feel daunting. But this morning, I invite us all to take a pause before we begin that work. Let's stop the poem about halfway through. Yes, the song of angels is still, the stars gone in the sky, the kings and princes are home, and the shepherds are back with their flock. But let's not begin the work of Christmas just yet. Instead, I invite us to rest in a liminal time. Are you familiar with that word, liminal? It's sort of an in-between place. It's like a twilight. Let's rest in this liminal time between the fanfare of the holiday season and the hard work of the coming year. Let's use this time to replenish our energies, to renew our spirits. And one source that we can turn to for renewal is actually Christmas itself. Not the specific theology of Christmas, not even the story of Christmas, but what I would call the common themes of Christmas, the themes of hope, peace, joy, and love. These are actually the themes of the Advent wreath, which is a ritual that many Christians use in the weeks leading up to Christmas. But of course, these are not just Christian themes. They are common to all of humanity. They are some of the spiritual riches of human experience. But the Christmas season provides an opportunity for us to reflect on these themes and how we might nurture them in our lives. And that's what I wanted us to do this morning. We're going to actually reflect on these themes through poetry and through quiet contemplation. And in the process, seek sustenance for the work of Christmas in the year to come. We'll begin with a poem called Messiah by Mark Doty, which Kimberly will read for us.
Aren't we enlarged by the scale of what we're able to desire? Everything, the choir insists, might flame. Inside these wrappings burns another, brighter life, quickened now by song. Hear how it cascades in overlapping, lapidary waves of praise. Still time to change.
This is one way of understanding hope. It is the recognition that everything might flame, that inside these wrappings burns another, brighter life. That is, to have hope is to believe that change is possible. It is to believe that there are sparks of new life present here and now, sparks within our own hearts, sparks within our families, within our communities, even within our political systems. To hope is to nurture these sparks, even when we see little evidence that they're going to turn into flames. This is not the easy path. The easy path is to assume that nothing will change, to assume that the future is a foregone conclusion. That is the definition of hopelessness. We lose hope when we envision a sequence of events following a particular path to a particular end, and we surrender to it. We surrender to that vision, and we close ourselves off to any other possibilities. This is something that many of us wrestle with in our personal lives. We find ourselves in a place that we want to change, but we lose hope of change. We lose hope of that, and we just assume that there is no promise of change, that the future holds no promise at all, just more of the same. And hopelessness is also common in the public sphere. If you think about the problems we face, trying to undo systemic racism, trying to combat the roots of terrorism, trying to change the hateful political rhetoric that now dominates our political system. Is there any reason to believe that anything will change? Any reason to believe that the future holds any promise at all? But sometimes it's only when we let go of the future that we can dare to be hopeful. Only when we let go of what we think will happen or should happen and open ourselves to the possibility of change that is present here and now, like a spark waiting to burst into flames. I invite you now to a time of quiet reflection. If you feel comfortable doing so, use this time to reflect on where you seek hope in your life. Use this time to open yourself to the possibility of change, to nurture the sparks of new life. And if that feels uncomfortable, then I invite you to use this as just time as an opportunity to rest. To rest here in the quiet, in the love of this community.
When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the woodrake rests in his beauty on the water, and where the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time I rest in the grace of the world, and I am free.
Wendell Berry describes the peace of wild things, a peace that we might seek in the midst of nature, among wood drakes, great herons, and still water. But what is the source of that peace? Is it something intrinsic to the natural world, something about the sounds and smells of wood and field? For some of us, that might be the case. But I think there's something else going on here as well. And the clue is in the last line. I rest in the grace of the world, Berry writes, and I'm free. He rests in the grace of the world. At the beginning of the poem, Berry writes about despair for the world, about how he fears for his life and that of his children. And yet here at the end, he can find rest in that same world. The external circumstances haven't changed. The wood drakes and herons can't protect him or his children, and yet he feels free. But you see, if we find peace in the natural world, it's not because that world is peaceful. If we find peace there or anywhere, It's because we have sought peace and we have found it within. I really believe this. Peace is not found in external circumstances. We can be sitting in the most serene place. We can be listening to the most beautiful music, and we can still be roiled by our worries. We can still be wrestling with difficult emotions. We can still be regretting the past, worrying about the future. At best, a peaceful environment of whatever kind points us to a peace that is within ourselves, a place within of stillness and quiet that we can tap into whatever is going on around us. That was actually my experience here on Christmas Eve. I was standing up here over there while after all the candles had been lit, and we are just beginning to sing Silent Night. And up until that moment, I got to say my head was spinning. The last few weeks had been crazy busy for me, and I just hadn't had a chance to catch my breath. And to make matters worse, I had a cold, a pretty fierce cold, in which I have cough drops handy. I had a fierce cold that really had sapped my energy. And so when I came into the service that on Christmas Eve night, I really wasn't in a place of peace. But seeing our candles lit and hearing our voices lifted in song, I felt peace flow into my heart. It was such a new sense of peace for me, and yet I also knew that it was not new. I knew immediately that that place of peace had always been there. I had just lost sight of it. And that's how it is often. But if we find a way to touch that stillness within, we might find peace, whatever our circumstances. I invite you now into another moment of quiet reflection. And in that quiet, I invite you to think about where you find peace. That is, what makes it possible for you to find that peace within? Let us sit with that question.
So this poem is by Rabindranath Tagore in his book, Gitanjali. Let all the strains of joy mingle in my last song, the joy that makes the earth flow in the riotous excess of grass, the joy that sets the twin brothers, life and death, dancing over the wide world, the joy that sweeps in with the tempest, shaking and waking all life with laughter, the joy that sits still with its tears in the open red lotus of pain, and the joy that throws everything it has upon the dust and knows not a word.
Where is joy to be found? As Tagore sees it, joy can be found in any circumstance, shaking and waking all life with laughter, but also with its tears on the open red lotus of pain. When I first read Tagore's poem, it made me rethink my understanding of joy. I think I'd always thought of joy as something akin to happiness, just more so. It was, you know, the difference between happiness and joy was simply a matter of intensity. But I don't think that's the case, not anymore. Joy, I suspect, is more akin to gratitude. Joy, as Tagore suggests, often leaves us speechless at first, simply overwhelmed with feeling. And I think that's because joy is almost always involuntary. We can't conjure up joy. It simply wells up within us. It wells up within us without our bidding, from somewhere deeper inside than our conscious thought. But when we do find our voice, we almost always speak words of thanksgiving. Not just, I am so happy, but I am so happy because. I am so happy because and whatever that might be. Joy, you might say, is a sense of elation that springs from a deep-seated feeling of gratitude. And this is an important connection for us. Perhaps we can't experience joy on command, but what we can do is cultivate gratitude. We can cultivate gratitude by learning to be more conscious of the gifts that we receive in life, the gifts of every moment. Such conscious reflection, it might not produce joy immediately, but it might make us more open to joy. The practice of gratitude, the practice of reflecting on the gifts in our life, may open us to joy and make joy possible. Let us share another moment of quiet reflection. And in the quiet, very simply, I invite us to practice gratitude, giving thanks for the gifts of our lives, whatever they might be.
Our fourth poem is titled "Some Kiss We Want" by Rumi. There is some kiss we want with our whole lives, the touch of a spirit on the body. Seawater begs the pearl to break its shell, and the lily, how passionately it needs some wild darling. At night, I open the window and ask the moon to come and press its face against mine. Breathe into me. Close the language door and open the love window. The window won't use the door, only the window.
This poem reflects an understanding of divine love that is found in many religious traditions, especially among the mystics. I open the window and ask the moon to come and press its face against mine. Breathe into me. Close the language door and open the love window. This metaphor emphasizes that love cannot be confined by our tidy concepts, by what the poet calls the language door. When we think rationally about love, we have a tendency to begin rationing our love, choosing to love some people more than others. And the mystics will tell you that divine love, true love, is not like that. Instead, it is like the moon, indiscriminate and gratuitous, shining its light on everyone in sight. Now, it's tempting to associate such lofty language with divine love alone, to relegate it to some heavenly realm like the moon itself. But that would be a mistake. The mystics hold up such visions of divine love not to humble us, not to suggest that divine love is so different from human love. Instead, they hold up these visions of divine love to inspire us to love likewise. That's asking a lot of us. There's no doubt about it. But such love, or however close we can get to it, is vital to the work of Christmas. It gives us the audacity that we need to face this broken world, to face this broken world and bring healing and wholeness wherever it is needed, indiscriminately and gratuitously. I invite you into one last time of reflection. And in this time, I want you to think about this vision of love, this vision of the moon that shines its light indiscriminately. I invite us all to think about what would it be like to love like that? What would it be like to feel that love fill our heart? Let us share this last moment of reflection. hope, hope, peace, joy, and love. These are the gifts of the holiday season. I think this is why we have a holiday like Christmas, to remind us every year of the power of hope, peace, joy, and love. To remind us every year that we can draw upon these in our lives and in our work. As we close today, I just invite us to hold these things in this space, to claim them as our own. May these be the gifts that we take from this Christmas season. Amen.